nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I shall be brief. Chemistry is historically an experimental field, and so it's only really been over the last couple of decades that that computational methods have become really deeply embedded in chemistry. And I thought I might amuse you by taking you back to the mid-1800s to the natural philosopher Auguste Comte, who said, every attempt to employ mathematical questions in the study of mathematical methods in the study of chemical questions must be considered profoundly irrational and contrary to the spirit of chemistry. And so, as you can see, today we live in degenerate times. By the 1930s, in volume one of the Journal of Chemical Physics, G.N. Lewis, who was the inventor of the electron pair theory that we still teach our first year undergraduates, admitted that in the Schrodinger equation, we have the mathematical foundation for the solution of the problem of atomic and molecular structure, but here's the Full Employment Act for quantum chemists. The problem of the many bodies contained in the atom and the molecule cannot be completely solved without great further development in mathematical, and I might add, computational technique. And then by the late 1960s, when Robert Mulliken won the Nobel Prize for his work on molecular orbital theory, he emphasized his belief that the era of computing chemists, when hundreds if not thousands of chemists will go to the computing machine instead of the laboratory, is already at hand. There's only one catch. Someone must pay for the computing time. These days, it's the many people who buy Microsoft Office for all kinds of non-scientific purposes who pay for most of the computer time, lets us get cheap machines. So anyway, that's perspective. And of course, all of this is about trying to go and solve the Schrodinger equation, which is an exponentially difficult problem. And so we, in quantum chemistry, play in a phase space that trades off accuracy against feasibility. And as you can see here, approximations are essential, although there's a little asterisk, and the little asterisk is that that's assuming classical computers. And nothing simulates a quantum system like a quantum computer, and so those considerations of exponential difficulty actually evaporate away if you're trying to do things on a quantum computer. And this was a fun project that Alain Aspirou-Guzik and Tony Dutoy did in my group a couple of years ago, was to simulate on a classical computer a quantum algorithm and actually produce numbers and show the numbers of qubits required. Well, no one has a quantum computer yet, so in reality, we are stuck in computational quantum chemistry with trying to make well-defined theoretical models. We've heard about density functional theory already today, and I'll just mention a few words about wave function-based electronic structure theory. I'll try and tell you a bit about what is done routinely these days with these methods, and then I'll tell you a bit about what I think are the interesting open issues from a couple of different points of view, but not primarily the computer architecture point of view that you've already heard a lot about. So you've got the choice, approximate the wave function or develop a functional of the density. Either can be exact, but neither is exact in practice. DFT is the predominant method. It's essentially the sweet spot between accuracy and feasibility, and as we saw very beautifully in Eric's talk just a few minutes ago, you can do very large systems, and in some sense, DFT is the present-day sweet spot between accuracy and feasibility. Electron correlation at mean field cost, you can't beat that. But it has weaknesses, and we'll come back to some of those because they represent future opportunities. DFT is not systematically improvable, and there are errors, physical errors, associated both with the unknown exchange functional and the unknown correlation functional, both of which must be approximated in practice. Wave function methods to approximate the Schrodinger equation have complementary strengths and weaknesses to DFT. It has the strength that DFT lacks, which is the ability to systematically improve the answer towards the Schrodinger limit, but it comes at a cost that is far beyond DFT, which is steeply increasing computational scaling as a function of size of the molecule. And what I'm indicating here is the polynomial power law scaling with the number of atoms A in the molecule, which starts off at mean field, essentially cubic, rising through fifth, sixth, and seventh powers of molecular size. So essentially, we have a raft of well-defined theoretical model chemistries, as the great Nobel laureate John Popel described them, available now and ready to use. And that requires software, and I am in part a software developer. I am the 69th name in this massive list. So it takes a lot of friends to develop a good quantum chemistry code these days, and those are my friends. I have many other friends apart from them too, but this is a million line code, and it's cumbersome. It was a blank sheet in 1993, and now it's a million lines of legacy code, as well as some new stuff. People really use these codes, and so what I want to emphasize here is the ubiquity of the use, and this is a slide that actually Emilio Artacho just prepared about a week or so ago for an article he and I are writing together. So look at program citations as a function of year, and in the late 1980s and early 90s, this took off and is now, and this is surely an underestimate because we don't have all the codes represented here, it's now on the order of many thousands per year. Here are the corresponding citations to generalized gradient approximations, the leading ones, and the leading hybrid generalized gradient approximation. That includes exact exchange, which is common in chemistry. And this is giving you a sense of how widely used these methods actually are in the chemical community. Truly, tens of thousands of chemists now use them routinely, and they are thus a complement to experiment. Why? Well, because they're useful. So here is a quick example showing the elaboration of a catalytic reaction pathway, finding elaborately all of the minima, the saddle points, the corresponding optimized structures that gives you a reaction path. And that can be done with enough realism that you can then reproduce the kinetics, the observed experimental rates, to within a factor of 10 or so in this case. You can do quite large systems even when non-local dispersion interactions are important. Here's the coupling between a fullerene and tetraphenyl porphyrin, computing something that would not be so appropriate to do by DFT, finding a binding energy that's a good fraction of a chemical bond, 30 kcals per mole or so. So what are the lessons that come to us then from this kind of mass usage that has turned up in computational chemistry over about the last 15 years? The vast majority of our users are not experts. They're experimentalists. They have no undergraduate training in computational chemistry. This is clearly something that we should address in our undergraduate curriculum, and the situation is slowly changing, but that will be the next generation who knows about that. The people who are using the methods right now are not trained, and so one might immediately worry about a crisis of competence in the very widespread application of these methods to chemical problems. But I'm happy to say that I, at least, think there's very little evidence of that so far. And it indicates to me that essentially our users tend to be intrinsically skeptical experimentalists who do the kind of obvious checks that they would do to any black box instrument that they were using to try and avoid getting garbage numbers coming out. And I think it's also aided by the simplicity of the widely used notion of a theoretical chemical model, whereby the input is just the atoms and the electrons that make up the molecule, an atomic orbital basis set attached to each atom that's very standardized, and the choice of correlation model, which would be DFT or one of the wave function models. So this makes it quite easy for even a non-specialist who has no idea about the equations, no idea about the physics, to understand roughly when these methods work and when they fail, and therefore to use them reasonably well. So in that sense, our mass usage experience has been rather encouraging. But you might then think, that most of the exciting stuff is done, and that if you're a developer of quantum chemistry software, you might be feeling a bit similar to someone who worked on mass spectrometry or X-ray crystallography or NMR or these techniques that have become sufficiently standardized that the instrumentation is taken over by small-scale companies or medium-scale companies, and what's left to do? Well, I believe that the maturity that's expressed by this mass adoption is really quite deceptive. Essentially, we've got smart users who are able to avoid the current limitations of the methods. Not that we have foolproof methods. We've got smart users. Even our algorithms are in a state of flux. We don't do basic operations the way we did them 5 or 10 years ago. For instance, we don't do true two-electron integrals anymore when we describe theories of electron correlation. We use resolution of the identity to very rapidly re-express them in terms of three- and two-center integrals. So there's a lot to do, and I'll just spend a few minutes now telling you about what I see as some of the challenges and try and actually avoid my chairman getting up on me. So essentially, DFT, this first major branch from the point of view of methods developers in computational chemistry and in condensed matter theory, really confronts the lack of systematic improvability. So if you are trying to overcome limitations of the exchange functional, and those limitations are the physical effect of self-interaction, that an electron can unphysically see a bit of itself, it is very difficult to do it within the framework of the successful functionals we have right now. I'll show you an example of this just to show you how dramatic it can be. And then we also confront limitations of the correlation functional. It doesn't include London forces. That's what makes colloids attract each other and gives rise to non-bonded interactions in biosystems. And the correlation functionals we have right now are not powerful enough to treat strongly correlated systems, such as where electrons on multiple transition metal atoms couple antiferromagnetically to low spin states. And as we've seen in a couple of other talks, we have the continuing challenge of developing fast algorithms that could change almost everything. And indeed, in principle, there's a linear scaling manifesto which says in the end all electronic structure theories will scale linearly. It's just a question of what system size it takes for linear scaling to kick in. And there's another caveat, which is linear scaling has to be done with high precision, because in quantum chemistry, we're interested in chemical reaction energies, which are very tiny energy differences between huge absolute energies. So we have to solve our chemical models, even if they're not very exact models, we have to solve them very precisely to get significant energy differences. So these are challenges that are going to confront us for a while. So what about self-interaction? It shows up in the world's simplest molecule, which is the one electron molecule, H2+. And this is the potential curve by mean field theory, which of course is exact for a one electron system, and by the most popular density functional in chemistry, which is the B3 lip functional. It's a good functional. Things look fine around equilibrium, but as you stretch, you see a very large error by about 3 angstroms of separation between the two hydrogen atoms. It's an error of some tens of kilocalories per mole. And if you keep on going beyond 3 angstroms, you discover that was a saddle point right there. And it settles down to a really vile and incorrect asymptote, which is something like 50 kilocalories per mole lower than the energy of a proton and a hydrogen atom together. And that state is half an electron on either hydrogen atom. Should be the same in energy, but it isn't because of self-interaction. So it's dramatic. We just have users who are smart enough not to separate odd electron problems into fragments and things like that. Well, what about challenges for wave function theory? Well, there's this artificial increase of computational scaling with size, n to the fourth, n to the fifth, n to the sixth, n to the seventh. That has nothing to do with the locality of electron correlation. It just has to do with the nature of how many coupling matrix elements you have in many-body theory. So taking that out requires the development of so-called local correlation models. This is an active field right now, but there's not enough progress in it yet to say that we're anywhere near done. So this is a challenge for new people to look at and try and make advances on. Treating strong correlations tractably is also a challenge for wave function-based methods, because essentially if you simply go looking at active space methods, which is trying to solve the Schrodinger equation in a subspace of strongly correlated orbitals, well, that's a Schrodinger equation. Maybe the density matrix renormalization group coming out of condensed matter physics shows promise for at least one-dimensional problems. And reduced density matrix methods are another novel approach. So these essentially advances in these methods would overturn again the foundations that we have right now and emphasize the fact that this is not a mature field. We've made enough progress to be credible, but not enough to really say we've stabilized. And we also need to overcome very slow convergence with atomic orbital basis set. That's inherent in the wave function-based treatment of correlations, because a correlation is a two-electron interaction, and we're trying to describe it with products of one-electron functions. It's just not a natural way to do it. So one would like to incorporate two-electron functions, functions of R12, for instance. That's one way forward. Another way forward are the quantum Monte Carlo methods that have been pioneered actually by a member of our audience, Bill Lester, and really show quite a lot of promise and are very natural in the highly parallel context. So there's a lot to do. Here's just an example of a molecule we've worked on that shows some strongly correlated character. This was advertised in Chemical and Engineering News as the world's first indefinitely stable singlet diradical, which is nice. That would imply the HOMO and the LUMO, the highest occupied and lowest unoccupied levels, would be one electron each. But what we actually calculate, again, those occupation numbers are not experimentally observable and not accessible in density functional theory, we actually find it to be 17% diradical. So in fact, the reason this turned out to be experimentally stable is actually its moderate, unexpectedly low degree of diradical character. So anyway, there are interesting stories and interesting frontiers to do with correlated electrons. Other general challenges, well, linkages to theories at different length and time scales. All of the modeling we do right now is at the one scale of resolving the electrons. We need to go multi-scale. There are efforts being made now, but much more to be done, and linking to dynamics and statistical mechanics. Carl-Perinello type methods and ab initio and first principles molecular dynamics are great starts here, but much more to be done. Excited states, photochemistry, energy harvesting, these are some of the great problems that our country faces, and in quantum chemistry we face a much more modest version of them, which is simply how to make our models go and treat those kinds of problems that go beyond the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and questing more generally for physical insight. Not just doing numerical experiments, but since we've got wave functions, we've got density matrices, we should be able to learn more. And only in a limited way can we do that right now. So for people who are thinking about going into this field, I think there's more than enough to keep us occupied and enough credibility already gained by the tens of thousands of users. So here's just something that, well, it applies to my area, but maybe applies to everything. I think our most exciting days are ahead of us, even though there are some days when one looks at everything that's been accomplished and it seems like, well, maybe in fact most of the good stuff's been done. Ogg's discovered fire and Thorak invented the wheel and there's nothing left for us to do. But I think there is. Okay, thanks.
We have time for some questions. In fact, I guess we have a little bit of discussion before we need to get out of here. Maybe 10 minutes?
15.
I'd like to add something I think is still a challenge to your list, and that is that the ability to model chemical reactions, predict transition states and so forth, is still an art, I think. And a lot of the problems are coming from the fact that, first of all, it's difficult a priori to envision what the transition state would look like, but also potential wells are often rather shallow and close minima, a lot of interaction. And yet, measuring these rates is, in some cases, almost impossible. So quantum chemistry, by making that more reliable and faster, would do a great service, I think, to a lot of fields that need that information.
Yeah, it's a very good point. So really, the uncovering reaction mechanisms is one of the most important uses of quantum chemistry methods, and as you say, it is by no means as simple as it sounds. So you must identify the relevant minima that correspond to, well, reactants and products in the first instance, and then all of the intermediate states and saddle points that link those. And as I showed in one of the slides, when it comes to a catalytic cycle, there can be an enormous number of those, and it's difficult to be certain you've found them all. So there's an element of user skill involved in identifying what's chemically plausible, and there's an element of, again, looking at the reliability of DFT to see, make sure that the barriers are okay. Sometimes they tend to be underestimated. And in fact, there's a nuclear degrees of freedom. Cataloging exhaustively all of the local minima and all of the barriers is not a very rewarding job. One should be beginning to look at free energy considerations.
Yeah. Well, and actually, I was thinking of gas phase systems, never mind the complication of the surface.
Out of curiosity, when you're doing your literature search of how many citations, you know, various things, have you looked at how many times people have actually used reduced scaling methods in an application? So it's not just in a developing a new method sense, but is this picking up now, or is this...
That's a very good point, Eric. I know from users of our own code that it is very much the exception and not the rule. And this is partly because most reduced scaling methods operate at low precision, and setting things like cutoffs and tolerances and so forth is a finicky business to get high numerical performance while still obtaining reliable relative energies. It may be that Emilio can comment on the Siesta experience, but for us it's a pretty small minority of our users who actually use those methods routinely.
Well, it's essentially the same idea. So people using within Siesta, our code, using the linear scaling solving is minority. On the other hand, in the way we have the DFT code implemented, there's two branches to it. There is the calculation of the Hamiltonian and the solution of the Hamiltonian. The calculation itself is done always linear scaling because there is no other way in the code to do that. Solver is the one that it is still exceptionally used as linear scaling.
Mark, I have a question regarding the theory of some of these algorithms. What's the state of the art in terms of the convergence theory of a particular algorithm for a certain system or something like that? Or is that something that's well understood? Are you guys satisfied with that? Or are there any challenges there?
I'm sure there are plenty of good challenges, Juan, and I'm almost equally sure that I'm only dimly aware of what they are. If you look, say, at our couple cluster theories of electron correlation, those are solving systems of nonlinear equations where I'm sure there are issues about even the existence of solutions or multiple solutions and so forth. We tend to close our eyes and assume that the linearized version, of course, has a single solution, and we hope that nonlinear corrections, which are nonetheless rather physically important, don't substantially change that. I think there are lots of those issues. We certainly know, and you know from your work on just searching for the optimal one particle density matrix in DFT that can be a tricky issue in terms of multiple minima and ensuring solutions are actually stable with respect to, say, spin polarization. I think there are lots of interesting challenges that link, where good interaction between the quantum chemistry community and the applied math community would benefit both sides.
I have a couple of questions. So one is, if you could comment on what I think used to be more of a tug and pull between the people who wanted to start with the right Hamiltonian and use a wave function-based approach versus the people who wanted to sort of play with the Hamiltonian and use a density-based approach. And where do you see that going? Those two camps, and how do you see those different classes of approaches evolve?
Well, I don't know. I guess the simplest response is to say let 1,000 flowers bloom and see which blooms the brightest. So today, probably 80%+ of practical calculations in quantum chemistry are done with density functional theory, and the balance is done with wave function-based methods dominated by coupled cluster theory, because those are sort of the, you know, the right answer for the right reason, as long as you can afford it. In the future, we would be hoping, on the one hand, for better density functionals that incorporate London forces and suffer from less self-interaction, and on the other hand, we'd be hoping for coupled cluster accuracy with, you know, with reduced scaling. And so far, both of those goals really remain challenges for the future rather than things that, that we've completely grasped in the present. So, and then, you know, I don't know if you're thinking also about reduced density matrix methods. Those kind of loom on the sidelines, sort of hamstrung by the famous n-representability problem, but perhaps with new generations of constraints coming along to pin it down a little bit better.